This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hi, this is Paul Lathrop from the Politics and Guns Podcast. You're listening to Bob Main on the Handgun World Podcast.
Roland was a warrior from the land of the midnight sun, with a Thompson gun for hire, fighting to be done. The deal was made in Denmark on a dark and stormy day. So it set out for
Hi folks, Bob Main here with another episode of your weekly Handgun World Podcast. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Well, you know, Jason Christensen at Concealment Solutions and the folks over at White Dog Holsters, they don't make holsters big enough to carry cops with me. So I just decide to carry guns like cops do, right? That's my right. I can do that. Right? If the police can carry guns, why can't I? I mean, I'm a good guy, so that's kind of the way I feel about this whole thing. So this episode is about the Smith & Wesson M&P pistol, which a lot more police departments are starting to switch to. And, you know, the Smith & Wesson M&P pistol, I want to do a little introduction here before I bring this interview on. The introduction is this. I owned some Smith & Wesson M&P pistols shortly after they first came out. I had two 9mm, and I had the compact and I had the full size. At that time, when they first came out, the competition model did not exist. And, you know, as I cruised down the freeway here in my Handgun World mobile studio heading out to a business appointment, I started thinking about, okay, since this is an M&P show, let me think back to the M&Ps that I owned. And the only reason why I got rid of them, I just didn't like the trigger. And you're going to hear me talk more about that in the interview coming up. Well, the trigger's improved quite a bit. And I have to say I'm very impressed with the M&P Shield 9mm that I own. Very, very impressed. Good pistol. Very good pistol. Soft shooter, good trigger on it. I understand that on the larger models that M&P has improved the trigger a bit. And that's a good thing. So I have to admit something to you. After doing this interview and researching this, I think I need to get an M&P. I think maybe I need to try another M&P pistol again. And maybe there's a chance, I don't know, but maybe there's a chance that an M&P might replace one of my beloved Glocks. Let me just say this. There'll always be a Glock 19 in my family, and there'll always be a Glock 19 in my possession. But I am an open-minded guy, and I understand that there probably are pistols out there that might be better. And this interview is starting to make me think that way a little bit. Don't know yet. I don't know yet. The jury's still out and they're deliberating. They haven't come back with a verdict yet, but quite an intriguing interview. So, Ben Branham took an M&P armorer's class. And so you're going to hear Ben and I discuss the M&P armorer's class that he took. Stay tuned. Well, Ben Branham's back on the show. It's been a while, Ben. Welcome back.
Cool. Yeah, happy to be here. I can't remember the last time we did this. It's just nice to get together. We've been planning it for like a month, and we keep blowing it. So, hi, everybody.
Hello. Well, this show, we're going to talk about an M&P armorer's course you just took. So, all the Smith & Wesson M&P fans probably going to love this episode. Some of the Glock fans may not like it. I don't know, but you know, it is what it is. You just took an M&P armorer's course here in San Antonio at A Place to Shoot, where we teach a lot of our classes. Tell us about the class.
The class was a lot of fun. They had their representatives from actual Smith & Wesson employees were in. A guy named Chris and Bill, they were both sales reps, and they're certified to teach the armorer's course and stuff. So it was a lot of fun to talk to them about what's going on at Smith & Wesson and some of the things that are, you know, it's not really public knowledge, but it was a lot of fun to learn. Just asking questions during the breaks and stuff. So it was kind of cool that we had actual Smith & Wesson employees teaching it. It was the funnest thing. For me, it was an awesome class. They gave us all sorts of goodies. I got a hat. They ordered me a shirt. And they gave me a little armorer's kit and a Smith & Wesson bag. And the armorer's kit, you know, some of the tools are really nice. And then they gave us Harbor Freight like hammers to use, but you know, a mallet is a mallet, it doesn't really matter. But they gave us really nice punches and a couple really nice tools that are pretty expensive, so I appreciated that.
I missed out on the class. I'm really bummed, but my real job had me incredibly busy. But when I talked to you, Ben, after the armorer's course, you said you have a renewed liking for the M&P pistol.
Yeah, they've changed a bunch of things internally, and it's funny that as we were going through the class and we're taking apart the gun, we stripped it all the way down to the bare frame, and you know, some pieces came out that probably shouldn't have come out in a couple of the guns. You know, when you start taking things apart and springs start shooting across the room, you're like, huh, maybe we'll have to find that. But it was a lot of fun. I started looking at it and the way it's evolved, and Smith & Wesson hasn't really advertised how it has evolved, but there's a lot of little internal pieces that have just gotten better and better since they came out. When they came out, like 5-6 years ago?
I think it's longer than 6 years ago, but what? Tell us about some of the evolutions in their internal parts.
The internal parts are just like to make it easier to work on the gun and to make some of the parts more robust. Like Striker, you know, the Striker spring and everything, it comes apart really easy. The Striker is the part that hits the round and everything. And in a Striker-fired gun that's all internal, you don't see the firing pin. It's called the Striker. And the spring is wrapped around it that actually makes the Striker go forward. Well, that's if you take apart your Glock and go ahead and replace that spring, most people just replace the whole thing. Smith & Wesson comes apart really easy. But part of the thing they did it to make it more robust over the years is they used to have two little keepers that would sit in there and hold the spring onto the Striker. And if you ever work with two little tiny parts, you know, I got fat fingers, you know, those things were marred, destroyed when somebody would take them apart. You replace them all the time. Plus, you got two little pieces, and when the two little pieces, they're all in half and they kind of rub, they weren't as strong. So they've replaced that and put a one-piece keeper in there, which was super easy to work on. That was the thing I was impressed with the gun. It was just, I've taken my Glock and my 1911 down to bare frames and stuff and need all sorts of tools, punches. The Smith & Wesson, there was one little thing that you had to worry about when you were taking it apart and put it back together.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, though, pretty much you only need a punch to take a Glock completely apart.
Yeah, but it's, I don't know, for me it's like you got three pins that hold the, like the sear block. If you want to call it that, that's what Smith & Wesson calls it. The sear block is that little piece in the back of your Glock that holds the disconnector, the trigger return spring. It attaches to the trigger bar and all those little pieces in the back of the gun. There's three pins that hold that together. Glock and the Gen 4 went to two pins that hold that all in the frame. Smith & Wesson has one pin and it sits in grooves.
Okay.
And you can't put stuff in backwards. I found out with my Glock, you could put a lot of things in backwards.
Yeah, you did put something. I think you put in your, it was your slide lock you put in backwards once, didn't you?
I don't know who put that. That one I did not put in backwards. Somebody else put that one in backwards. I did not.
Sure, that's what they all say.
I did not take that out of my gun. But I have put the trigger return spring in backwards, the spring that goes to the trigger bar, and that sear block, I put that in backwards, and the gun still works. It just doesn't work well.
So with the M&Ps, you can't put them in backwards?
The only piece you can put together backwards is like the trigger return spring, and if you put that in backwards, the gun won't work. You could put it together backwards and put it all together, and once you start trying the gun, the spring will fall off and it doesn't work in there, and you'll have to take it all the way back apart, put that spring in correctly. But that's not even in backwards. You could put it in upside down because it's a captured spring. So you'd have to bend the spring to get it off to put it in backwards, but you could put it in upside down. So
okay.
That's kind of cool. I thought that was cool.
Well, yeah, that is cool. So you were mentioning to me that after taking the M&P Armorer's course that you're thinking about replacing your Glock 19 with an M&P pistol. Why? Explain that.
Well, one, I'm getting tired of a Glock. I never really liked Glock. I just kind of ended up with it. If you guys heard me before, I ended up with a Glock. It's not like I chose a Glock. I was issued one, and then I was too lazy to retool and retrain myself. And I'm just getting tired of my Glock. I've got that Gen 3 I've got is sweet, all set up, but I've got tons of aftermarket parts in there. The 3.5-pound disconnect that's not the factory spec. It's a lighter trigger. I've got all the parts polished. all these, I can't even shoot IDPA in the normal Glock category because I put stuff on the outside of the gun, that beaver tail, so I don't cut my hand on the stupid slide. And I got all these upgraded sights, all this stuff, and the gun is starting to look like a Franken gun. And especially, I looked at my Gen 4 the other day that I got all this stuff done, and then I have to really, I didn't want to put that 3.5 pound disconnect in there and have all the parts polished because it's my carry gun. Well, I have to work like immensely, like huge, more work than I ever think I need to pull that trigger in dry fire and not have those sights move. It's just a lot of work for me. And I know that sounds weird, but I can pick up a 1911, Ruger, all these other guns, just pick it up, pull the trigger nice and smooth to the rear, and have that gun go click without those sights moving.
Did you find the same with the M&P?
I did. That was the impressive thing, is I got to play with their brand new like guns that came out. They're only a couple years old, a year or two, I think the guy said, about a year old. But it's funny, he's got these guns that are all beat up in the class that you all get issued a 9mm gun to play with for the day, and they've never been fired. But they're all beat to hell because all they do is get taken apart, put back together, taken apart, put back together, played with by guys in the class like me. But I don't know, the trigger was a lot different than the first run. I shot a gun that came out, one of the first ones that came out of the factory I got to shoot. You know, that first round, somebody bought one brand new when they first came out, and he let me shoot it. And the ergonomics felt great, everything, but that trigger was really crummy on that first round one. Now, this one, it's not like the Glock. You've got you've got more take-up on that first shot, but then shot to shot, the rock is about the same. And it feels different. It's not really crisp and smooth like the Glock. You can feel it's like two parts go clunk together when you go to that reset. The Smith, not so much, but I can feel where it is. So I could rock the trigger and it won't feel bad if I miss it. And just a lot of things, the way I shoot, I think the Smith & Wesson would be better for me. And then it's got, I know everybody's going to whine, that doesn't have that Glock angle. It's got an 18 degree grip angle just like a 1911. It doesn't have the higher angle like the Glock. I know it's only a couple degrees, but I can... It's different. Trust me. When I point the pistol, it's different.
Yeah, it is. So one of my big criticisms of the M&P over the years, and I've owned a couple of M&Ps, so... And I owned some of the early ones. I owned them when they had just come out. I think they were only out like about a year. So I had a couple of the earlier models. I just couldn't stand the trigger. I thought the trigger was awful. It had a lot of take up, had a nice, decent break. Then it had a lot of over travel, and the reset was soft and mushy. But you're saying all that's improved?
Yeah, and the over travel I can't prove on the older ones, but the newer ones have over travel stops that are set at the factory now. On the back of the trigger itself, there's a little nub, and then on the frame itself, there's another little nub.
Oh, there's one on the frame, too?
Yeah, so then you have that. There is no more over-travel. You have an over-travel stop, so it stops the trigger from moving farther. So it should be pretty close, and I didn't notice any over-travel in the one I was playing with, but then again, I had the one that was... It's been taken apart and put together probably more times than a gun should be.
So in the armorer's course that you took, what... Give a couple of highlights of what you really liked about the M&P design and what you didn't like. Because you told me there were some things you didn't like. Start with a couple of things that you really liked.
For me, it was super simple to see how the gun worked. A Glock, I haven't taken a Glock armor's course, but I've taken my Glock all the way down the frame, all the springs, everything, and the slide completely apart. I understand how to do it. I understand how to replace parts. I understand how to put it back together. I understand how to fix what's broken, but I don't really have an intimate understanding how the gun works, how that sear release is in there, and where it really is, and how that disconnector actually totally works on the Glock. I'm not really sure on all that. Part of the class didn't even talk about this in the Smith & Wesson, but when I took it apart and started taking all the parts together and put it back together, I looked at it and I'm like, well, there's the sear. That's super easy. There is an actual sear on that sits on top that's under on a rocker under a spring, and when you pull the trigger, it pushes on that sear and it rocks it up to release the striker. Super, super simple. And then when it's a double single action, just like the Glock, so, you know, half of the spring is set when the slide is racked.
Half cocked, you mean, right?
Yeah, half cocked. And then the other half of the spring, you pull the trigger. Well, you can see where all those parts move. I can see where they come together. I can see where it's pushing on the striker to put the spring all the way together. Super, super simple. And then, like, there's no gauges to see if there's no-go gauges. It's pull on the striker. If the spring is tough, it's a good spring. If the spring is broken, when you pull on the striker and you take apart the gun, it'll be painfully obvious that your gun is broken and it needs work. It may still fire, but, you know, it's one of those inspection points you can do. With the Glock, it's like, we just change out that striker spring just out of habit almost. You just kind of, you know, Glock says do it every so often. And
right.
they do it every so often. You know, nobody knows what so often is. So kind of that was a cool thing for me too, because I shoot the crap out of my guns and it's like, well, do I just keep shooting it until it doesn't work and then replace the spring? Or do I just need to allocate funds every, you know, once a year, do I just need to buy a spring kit from Glock and replace the springs? And then on the other half, Glock will not sell me parts to the internal parts of the gun because I'm not a certified armor.
Will Smith & Wesson do that?
I don't know, honestly, but as a certified armor, they're super cheap.
Well, now you're a certified armor, right?
Yeah. And the sear block, which is the rear little part we talked about, for the Smith & Wesson, if you buy it over the counter, it's $26 for that whole piece. Has the sear, all the springs, like the whole Glock where the disconnector is, that whole part put together is $26.
So if I buy an M&P, now I have a good source for parts.
Yeah, I can get you some. And rumor has it that they were talking about giving me an armorer's kit at that course too. So I'm going to follow up with them and see if they're going to give me that $600 armorer's kit, which should have just about enough parts to build two or three guns in it.
Well, let's talk about taking them apart. What's easier to take apart, the Glock or the M&P?
Oh, the M&P?
M&P's easier?
Oh, way easier. Two roll pins for the frame and one directional pin, and everything falls out of the gun. That's it.
Well, I thought that's how you pretty much take apart a Glock, too.
Three pins on the front, three pins on the back, one or two on the front, plus two on the front, and then everything starts falling apart. It's just
okay.
A bunch of pins.
So really, it's not any more difficult. You think it's a little bit easier on the M&P?
I think it's a lot easier on the M&P. It just, for me, it came apart really easy. I mean, I was way ahead of the class. The instructor's like, pull these pins out, and I was like, hey, look, this looks like a Glock, only simpler. I understand it. Pop, it all comes apart. Okay. You know, the only part that's tricky with the M&P, there's one spring that's not captured, so you can lose that. Be careful, don't lose that one little spring.
Which spring is that?
It's actually the spring that holds the takedown lever. Okay. So if you lose that, your takedown lever will not pop in and out of place, you know, up in 90 degrees to take the gun down. It will just roll back and forth. It's a little flat spring that just, it got a little bend L in it, and it sits inside the block.
So for M&P owners, maybe stocking some extra takedown springs would be a good idea.
That one, yes. That's one of the things I will buy if I have one, because if I take it apart and that little spring falls out, oh man, finding that's going to be a problem.
All right, so what did you not like about the M&P?
Not like? There's a couple things that have got to be factory replaced, unfortunately. The slide, we didn't remove the front sight. It's dovetailed in, but the instructor says, yeah, we don't hammer on those because they're just too, they're designed not to come out, really, from the factory. They press those in with a huge press, and they don't really want to come out. So the way they do that is you have a sight pusher tool to get those in and out. Kind of a pain in the butt to have an extra tool, but you know, most gunsmiths have one. I don't. I should probably break down and buy one. I normally just beat the crap out of my sights to get them in and out. Glock says you need a sight pusher tool to get their rear sight out, but I can do it with a punch. And I've gotten the plastic ones out with a punch without breaking them.
The plastic ones, you can almost use the pliers and break them and
yeah,
pull them out with the pliers.
You can break them and rip them out, so that's pretty cool.
Well, all right, so, yeah, changing the front sight is a pain in the butt on the M&Ps. I've heard a lot of people say that, you know, so that's one of the downsides. Unless you've got the proper tools, you pretty much need to take it into a gunsmith, whereas I've changed out front sights on Glocks, and it's an absolute piece of cake.
Yeah, the front sight on Glock is just a screw, a bolt.
Yeah, and normally when you buy sights, you get that little sight wrench.
Except for the last two sets I've bought. They haven't given me the stupid sight wrench.
I got about four of those sight wrenches anyway for Glocks. All right, so that's one negative of the M&P, change in sights. And, you know, I'm surprised that Smith & Wesson made it that tough, because sights, everybody likes different types of sights, and many gun owners like to change their own sights whenever they feel like it and not have to run to a gunsmith that's got a sight pusher.
Yeah, and I agree that, and then Smith & Wesson even agrees with that, because they don't even make an alternate sight. They don't offer the gun. They offer the gun with the white three-dot sights, and that is it.
They don't offer them with night sights?
Nope. They let third parties do all that. They don't even offer them with night sights.
So they don't offer them with night sights. They let third parties, but they make it more difficult to change the sights.
Yeah, it's kind of a pain in the butt.
Okay. You also were saying one of the things you didn't like is to get the plunger spring out, you have to take the rear sight off, don't you?
Yeah, and I'm not sure. It's not a dislike. It's just that, you know, you drift that rear sight to adjust your windage. So if I need to replace the plunger spring and the plunger, when I say plunger, that's the safety plunger, so the striker can't move
it's
forward.
It's the firing pin safety. A lot of people call it a firing pin safety.
Yeah, for you 1911 guys, that's the Series 70 versus the Series 80. If you don't know what that is, don't worry about it. But 1911 guys, now you know what I'm talking about. But to get that spring out, you have to take the rear sight off. And then that's the plunger and the spring come out the top of the slide. So it's kind of weird, but, you know, how often do you replace that? The only thing is, if you're going to replace that spring, now you got to go out and re-zero your gun. You got to confirm your zero. There's a couple tricks. You know, armors know tricks, and I know tricks. You know, you put a mark on your sight and on the slide with a piece with a pencil. You put one line on both of them, and then you line the lines back up.
Yeah, I wouldn't trust that. I'd still go zero it, though.
I'd still want to go shoot it to confirm that, but it gives you a good idea and a good starting point. So that's kind of a pain. The other two things that I see that were kind of weird and I kind of, the striker, it sits in a channel, like just like a Glock, but it's not a steel channel. In there is a, like for better, it's a plastic tube pressed into the slide that holds that. And that way, it's designed not to have any oil or anything on it, because it's a piece of metal running inside of a piece of plastic.
And the plastic tube is pressed into the slide, so the plastic tube doesn't come out?
Right.
Because on a Glock, when you take the whole firing pin assembly, the plastic tube comes out, I believe.
Not that plastic tube. The whole channel isn't steel. It's oversized, and then a plastic tube is put inside that channel and pressed in there by the factory. So you cannot remove that by yourself.
Okay.
And where that comes part of, you guys that are lazy out there and want to use brake cleaner, gun scrub, WD-40 on your gun, when you start spraying that stuff in there, you start ruining that plastic. And if you ruin that plastic, that slide has to go back to Smith & Wesson for them to press in it. You know, they pretty much got to chip it out and then press in a new one for you.
I'm not a big fan of gun scrubber. All right, so when people are cleaning their M&Ps, what's the proper way to do it?
No gun scrub, no brake clean, no WD-40. You got to use a gun oil or a gun, you know, CLP, Hoppy's Works, all that stuff. But they even say don't put any oil or anything down that tube.
Well, Glock says the same thing. Glock says don't let any oil or anything get inside the firing pin channel. Same goes for M&Ps, although if you do it with an M&P, it sounds like it causes even a worse problem than with Glocks.
You could damage the gun. With a Glock, all you got to do is, you know, pull the whole slide apart, clean that channel out, and you're back in business. The M&P, I don't know if you do or not, but you could damage the gun.
Right, because Glock says it'll slow down the firing pin, but you're not going to damage your slide.
Right, so same thing there. And then the other thing that's kind of weird is Smith & Wesson, a Southern boys would say there's a twang in there. And the trigger return spring is actually just a kind of a piano-wired spring, and it's kind of long. So they found when they were pressing the trigger and then releasing it real fast, the gun would kind of twang on you. And you'd hear that, and that was that spring just releasing, and so you'd hear it vibrate a little bit. So there would be a little twang out of your gun, which was really weird. If you ever heard your gun go whang when you release the trigger, you'd be kind of like, huh, that's not right. What's wrong with that? So Smith & Wesson did, you know, instead of a complete redesign on the gun, the easiest thing they did was they took a piece of cotton and they put it inside that spring. Well, if you take apart the gun and you look in there, there's a piece of cotton, and you're like, what is that for? And you can see it if you look really close without breaking down all the way to the frame. If you just field strip it to clean it, you look really close, you'll see that. Well, some guys want to put oil and everything else on there. Well, if you put gun oil on a piece of cotton, what's it do? It breaks it down.
Breaks it down, yeah.
So eventually all that stuff will come out of your gun, and you have to clean it out because it'll get stuck in there. And then when you release that trigger real fast, you're going to hear that twang. Kind of weird. So kind of weird, but not really an issue. Just kind of something weird, you know. It seems like, well, you know, wouldn't you redesign the gun or something? But I guess if it works, it works. And it seems to be working.
So would you agree, as with Glocks, it's important with M&Ps also not to over-lube them?
Yeah. M&P says, or Smith & Wesson says, you should lube them a little bit more than your Glock. You know, Glock is three drops, right?
Three or four. What are the major lubing points on an M&P?
Same thing as your Glock, but there's like seven of them. Yeah, seven drops, and now I'm trying to think.
Where did they tell you to put them?
Four would be on the rails, so one on each captured part of the rail, and then one where the sear and the trigger bar meet.
Wait, one on each rail is two.
Well, there's four pieces of the rail that stick up, just like your Glock.
Oh, I got you.
You got
okay.
The two yeah. rear ones and the two front ones. They say one drop on each rail.
Okay.
So that would be four, and then one on the trigger sear, just like Glock says, pop a drop in there.
Right.
And then, I'm going to have to look at my notes. I forgot where the other one was.
But the trigger sear, I don't think you'd have to do that every single time.
No, but it was, you know, the Glock says four drops and they said seven.
Well, I think you're forgetting the top of the barrel. Probably that's important.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Thank you. It was the top of the barrel hood, and then the front of the barrel where it locks up.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, you put that on just about any gun.
So it's a little bit more, but very similar to lubing like a Glock because of the similarities of the internals.
Yeah, I'm thinking that it'll probably work either way.
So you like the trigger design better on the M&P?
Yeah, it was just simpler to see how it worked, and if you wanted to polish it, I was like, oh, look, polish right there. You know, if I wanted to change it a little bit, of course Smith & Wesson says, you know, don't be polishing the triggers, don't be changing out, putting in an Apex trigger, that's not what this course is about. Yada, yada, yada. Just like every other out there, they say don't change any of this stuff.
Now, competition shooters love the Apex triggers. And I got to tell you, I've shot some M&Ps with the Apex trigger kit. For competition, fantastic. You know, for carry, I'm a little bit on the fence. I'm a little on the fence because there is an Apex trigger kit that doesn't reduce the pull weight much. All it does is change, basically, the feel and the reset of the trigger. You know, so I'm kind of on the fence on that.
And now, they offered me an awesome deal to buy an M&P, so I'm going to buy an M&P 9mm.
And hang on a second. What he's about to tell you is why I'm jealous and why I'm upset I didn't take this course. Go ahead and tell him the offer you got.
They're offering me an M&P for about a third of the retail price, so less than half by far. So I don't know what the fees are going to be, transfer fees, you know, FFL, all that stuff, but I'm going to buy one.
If you don't make some quick money, I'll pay you twice what you pay for it.
No, I think I'll keep it. I might have a Glock Gen 4 that I might sell, depending on how much I like this. But.
So here we are. We hear Ben Branham saying the G19 might get put into second place and an M&P might be first. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, because I'm thinking the M&P would be more conducive for me to run as a gun straight out of the box. And if you listen to Masada Yub, what's he tell you? Run the gun straight out of the box or you're going to have issues in court. So it'd be much better to run a gun straight out of the box. Plus, we live here in San Antonio, and it's really cool that Austin and San Antonio PD and a bunch of other PDs in the area just went to the M&P. So if I'm carrying the same gun as the cops, you can't argue anything about that.
Okay, now let me ask you a question. You mentioned this earlier, but can you confirm that the triggers are definitely different on the newer MPs versus the early models?
As in taking them apart and looking at them and telling you what part? No, but trigger feel, the ones that we had in class were way different than that first model. It was night and day.
Okay, because a lot of people have been asking that. Now, my Shield has a wonderful trigger. I like my M&P Shield's trigger. It's awesome. Is it similar to that?
Yeah, it's real similar. So I think whatever they did when they designed the Shield, you know, to cut it down, make it smaller and everything, I think they did the same thing with the bigger gun at the time. And like I said, there's been a lot of little design. I mean, even the slides that the guy had from Smith & Wesson, he had to add slides and change things because the gun has been, it's been evolving in the back door, and we just don't know it. Little parts have changed, little things. My favorite is we talked about that plunger. Well, that plunger spring used to have two pieces to it. You had the plunger, the spring, and a cap to put on it. Well, it was a pain in the butt to get the cap to stay and the actual sight to slide on. It was just stupid. So, funniest thing, Smith & Wesson, actually I found out they're such a great company. The guy that redesigned that spring and that cap was the guy that works the assembly line putting the things together. He said, why don't you just do this? And he made one on his spare time and said, we should do this. It'll make me easier to put them together. Your armors won't have any problems. You'll sell, you know, you'll have less spring problems and less, you know, less people upset. And, you know, the people at Smith & Wesson went, huh, that's a good idea. So it's kind of cool that they listen to the guy that's actually out there on the line building them. And that's where a lot of these little things behind the doors that we never see that just kind of gun evolves as it goes, that's where they came from. The guy on the line said, we should do this.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also, Smith & Wesson has a lifetime warranty, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes. Lifetime warranty, no questions asked, blah, blah, blah. Kind of the cool thing. All right, here's the other thing I'm kind of geeking out about the Smith & Wesson versus the Glock. The Smith & Wesson has a stainless steel supported frame. Like, there's stainless steel inside that plastic frame to keep it from drooping and stuff. If you ever seen some of the torture tests on Glocks, they start to get hot. They start to twist, that metal melts, or the, not the metal, the plastic actually melts a little bit because it gets so hot, and you start to have problems. Like Tiger McGee did a 1,000-round trigger job as fast as they could on that Glock, his Glock 19 carry. Well, the actual guide rod, you know, it's a captured spring and everything, the guide rod melted out the front and flew out of the gun. So you had that tolerance open up so far when they got hot that they lost the guide rod out of the front of the gun.
Yeah, you can change that by going to a stainless steel guide rod,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, but it's a Glock's credit. The gun never stopped running, but it is unnerving when you're firing and you see pieces flying out the end of your gun. Trust me, I've done it on other guns, and when you see pieces go fwing, you're like, huh, that's bad.
Yeah, whereas but Smith & Wesson ships it with a stainless steel guide rod.
Stainless steel guide rod.
Captured spring, right?
Captured spring, and they actually reinforce the front lug. If you look at the Glock, the plastic and the metal is even. If you look at the Smith & Wesson, the metal sticks out a little farther than the plastic on the end. And then they redid that lug on the end because they wanted it for law enforcement. And what do cops do with their guns? They drop them.
Yeah, and I've heard people say that, that the Smith & Wesson M&P frames are a little bit better reinforced than the Glock frames.
Yeah, so they're well, Glock only has one reinforcement part. Mm-hmm. And that's where they put the serial number. And contrary to popular belief, that little piece of steel was not put in there to put the serial number in there. It was put in there because that's the part of the frame that will melt and droop, and then you have the recoil spring fall off, and then the gun won't run. So they had to reinforce that little piece of metal there so it wouldn't melt and fall off.
Well, so by all accounts, what you're saying, mechanically, one would think that the M&P over the long term would end up being more durable, but that's kind of hard to believe because we all know about the great durability of Glocks, especially the 9mm versions.
That's going to be very interesting to find out, and honestly, we won't know for about
20 years?
Yeah, I was going to say, they've been out for almost 10 years, so another 10 or 15 years, we'll know if the M&P will keep up with the Glock. But so far in the torture test they've done, you know, 5,000 rounds through the guns on, the M&Ps work great.
Tell me if they covered this in your armors class. To the best of my knowledge, M&Ps were originally designed for the .40 caliber. Is that correct?
We didn't talk about that. I
think they were originally designed for .40. And now they have them in 9 and 45 and 357 SIG, whereas Glock was originally designed for the 9mm.
Well, I do have a bit of information for you, all you 40 geeks out there. Smith & Wesson makes completely supported chambers on all of them, where Glock runs an unsupported chamber on the 40s and the 45s. So if you're geeking out about that and you want to get geeky, Smith & Wesson is, because they do a different barrel, a complete different barrel set and die for all, every cal, well, I'm, I don't know, for 9mm, 40, and 45, it's completely different. Whereas Glock will cheat and use like a 9mm or a 40 barrel, will made out of the same die, and then they will cut the chamber and the rifling differently.
Yeah.
So you kind of got, and which is, you know, it's a cost of manufacturing. It's so much cheaper to do that. So, I mean, that's maybe why the Glock still retails like $25 cheaper than the Smith & Wesson.
By the way, I want to tell you about something earlier that you said when you were talking about IDPA and your Glock 19. If you switch to the now new Glock Beaver Tail backstraps, those are legal in IDPA.
Yeah, all I got to do is buy one, right?
Yeah, well, it's a factory part now. It's a factory part that Glock is shipping with every new Glock, so now it's IDPA stock service pistol legal.
Yeah, I know that, but Smith & Wesson has that nice beaver tail already built in.
On the full-size, not on the compacts.
I don't know. I didn't look at the compact, but
The compact lock, the compact M&Ps, I've never seen one with a beaver tail. Of course, I don't think they really need it because it seems like the slide sits slightly higher. The bore axis is slightly higher, not much, but it seems a little bit higher on the M&Ps, especially the compacts.
Well, it is over the Glock because you don't have the hand up so far. You got a little bit of space in there, more like your 1911 to change that grip angle. And then, they have the beaver tail on the Smith & Wesson. If you hold up a Glock and a Smith & Wesson together, you'll see that plastic sticks back way farther on the Smith & Wesson than the Glock. So you get almost a beaver tail, kind of 1911 grips safety kind of feel out of your Smith & Wesson. Where that Glock, if you're like me and have fat hands, I have Glock slide bike and I have scars because I've had it so long.
Right.
That when I fired the gun, I used to get, red track marks. The gun would make me bleed every time that I trained with it. So another reason I like the Smith & Wesson is I don't have to alter anything. It just picks up. It works. I guess Smith & Wesson's the same. It's kind of cool. Smith & Wesson is a totally ambidextrous gun. That you have a slide stop on both sides of the gun.
That's very important.
So you lefties might like that. And then the magazine release is reversible, so you can do it left or right side of the gun.
Well, the Glock Gen 4s are now, too.
Yeah, they're
But the Glock Gen 4s do not have the slide release on both sides.
Right, so either way, flip them around. That's kind of cool. There's one big spring in there. Don't break that spring because that spring is molded into the frame. But when we were playing with it at class, I was bending mine pretty far to see if it would break or not because it wasn't my gun. But it didn't break, so you'd have to really try to break that spring.
I'm glad you didn't take my shield apart. I lent you my shield for the class, and when I heard you didn't take it apart, and I thought, okay, well, good, nothing's broken, right?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have broken your gun. I didn't break that gun. Somebody else in class broke one of the guns. When you try to hammer something together with a big mallet, it's funny, the instructor the whole time is like, go ahead, use that big boy hammer, because he had a rubber mallet, and then he had a steel hammer. He says, go ahead, use that big bore gun and hit on it. And it was funny, I used that little rubber mallet, and it didn't take me anything more than nudging these things in and out. It was pretty easy. And other people, I hear them over there on the desk with that metal hammer, whack, whack. And I'm like, what are you doing? That part just fell out. So, yeah, a couple guys broke a couple parts, but it was pretty funny. He's like, nope, don't worry, I keep a lot of those on hand. Those get lost.
Well, it's good to hear you say this, because I've been a big fan of the Glock for mainly two reasons. Number one, it's durability, but number two, it's simplicity. That, so many people can do so many things by themselves to their Glock pistol, but it sounds like, based on what the armorer's class you went to, it's not that hard to do things yourself on the M&Ps.
I really think the M&P is even easier to take apart. So it'll be
surprising to hear you say that.
It'll be easier. Things like the extractor, super, super easy to take the extractor apart. And then when you take the extractor apart and you feel the piece of extractor that they're using in this thing and the way they designed the spring and everything, I don't see how it could ever break. I mean, maybe if you open the slide and hit it with a hammer, like a steel sledgehammer, you could get it to break. But, they call it an I-beam design. But when you look at this thing, for an extractor, it is a big piece of steel. And there's a big, huge spring that sits inside the slide. And there is a channel inside the slide that the spring sits in, so it's not like you could mar or break that spring. It's in there. It's captured by the slide itself. So you'd have to break the slide to get to that spring to break it. So it's kind of cool. Stuff like that, it's like, dude, this thing's indestructible right there. There's no way you're going to break an extractor.
Interesting. Now, a couple things. I wasn't at the class with you, but a couple of observations I've made as a user is that one thing I like about M&Ps, they will produce a pretty fair amount of guns either with or without a thumb safety. Whereas I don't see a whole lot of Glocks being produced, if any, with a thumb safety for people who like that.
Smith & Wesson's come out a lot of different ways, not just with the thumb safety. They will also come with a magazine disconnect safety.
Which I hate.
If you want one, they will make you one. They come with the thumb safety or without the thumb safety. If you want one, buy one with a thumb safety. The only thing about that is because of all this California, New Jersey, New York compliant BS guns, Smith & Wesson cannot ship you a safety for, even though the parts would drop right in to your gun that came without a safety, they won't do it. They match serial numbers because of the California, New Jersey, and New York compliant crap, which is just dumb because we all know it's the same gun with or without safety. And it pretty much functions the same. I like their safety design because we looked at it and how it was designed and everything. And when you put the safety on, you actually move the trigger bar over, and so the trigger is not connected to the sear anymore. Plus, there's a physical stop to keep the sear from moving. So you got the gun is no longer touching the trigger is no longer touching the sear or the striker. Plus, now you have a physical block in there that keeps it from moving.
Can you retract the slide with the safety engaged?
I don't know. I'm assuming yes, because I didn't get to play with one. I just got to study one and how it works in the pictures, and I got to look at your...
Well, we're about to walk into a gun shop. Maybe we'll test one out.
Maybe they got one.
If he's got one there.
And then I looked at the way yours works. You can engage the safety on the shield. And you can move it back and forth. So
I asked that question about... Yeah, okay. I'm sure somebody's going to chime in either on the forum or shoot me an email or a message or something like that, or a voicemail, and chime in on that.
Somebody has one that knows. But yeah, so that was kind of cool how I saw all the safeties and how they worked. I was really impressed with all that because there's no way the gun's going to fire when it's on safe. It's just not. Whether you pull the trigger or not, it's just not going to do it. Everything is blocked. So even if one part failed, the other parts would catch you. So it's kind of cool that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always been a big fan of M&Ps, too. I've always thought that they're very good quality guns. And, you know, maybe you're starting to change my mind. I'll never be without a Glock 19, but, you know, I'm looking at some other options. And I'm real impressed with this M&P Shield. Very impressed with it. And, you know, it's something, except for the Ameriglow front sight issue, which, hey, by the way, I got to put in a plug for Ameriglow. I actually had the tritium vial come out of the Ameriglow front sight on my shield. I was shooting it one day, and all of a sudden, the vial's halfway out. Called up Ameriglow, and within a week, they sent me, no questions asked, a brand new orange front sight with tritium in it. No questions asked. All I got to do now is find somebody with a sight pusher to replace it. So, way to go, Ameriglow. It's one reason why I like their sights. Top-notch service. Awesome stuff. But that certainly wasn't the pistol's fault.
And the last thing I actually like about the Smith & Wesson, I think they copied this straight out of some of the Glock users. You know, you Glock guys, you can put that little plug in there that has the armorer's tool to remove all the stuff from the Glock. If you were in a pinch, the way you take off the rear palm swell to change them, there is a little tool in there, and it's long, and it's plastic top and metal punch. If you were really in a pinch, you could take the gun down with just that tool, and it's already in the gun.
You can. Okay, cool.
So, yeah, and then, dude, to take the palm swells, so much easier. Glock, I don't know what they were smoking. To do the palm swell on the Smith & Wesson.
Palm swell. Smell. Sometimes on a hot day, like it is 105 in San Antonio, our palms will smell.
What's my truck say? Oh, it's only 94 in the shade.
Wait. We're cool. 94 in the shade.
All
right.
But, I went to work this morning, and I'm all dehydrated from working in the sun. That's why I can't talk. But anyways, to get rid of that palm swell, to change it, you know, Glock Gen 4 changes it. It's kind of the same deal. But on the Smith & Wesson, it's so easy. You take out the magazine, confirm the gun's unloaded, right? But I only say take out the magazine so you can see it. There's a little part that sticks down on the Smith & Wesson. Well, all you do is turn that 90 degrees, pull that little part out, and out comes the long kind of punch-looking deal. And the palm swell or that little back strap
comes off.
Just falls off.
Falls off, yeah.
So you put the new one in, and you just hold it in place, and you shove that little part back in there, and turn it 90 degrees, and
you're
done.
That's it. You can change it easily.
Oh, it's so easy. No punch, no roll pins, no nothing. And then, like I said, in a pinch, if you really had to do some maintenance in the gun or a pin started falling out while you were at a class or something, you could pull that part out, use it as a punch to put those pins back or replace a part, and then put it back in.
To Smith & Wesson's credit, they did a great job with the backstrap interchangeability. If I'm not mistaken, I think they were the first polymer pistol manufacturer to offer the interchangeable backstraps. I think they were. I don't know. Walther might have been before that. What I don't like, though, about the Walther, especially the PPS, once you take the backstrap off of that, the gun is inoperable. So I don't like that because... If that piece that holds the backstrap in, if that plastic piece happens to break, you have an inoperable gun, whereas with the M&P, I'm sure it's still going to fire, right?
Yeah, that backstrap has nothing to do with how the gun's put together. Yeah. So you could take out that little part and the backstrap, and the gun would still fire.
Yeah, so that was very well thought up. M&P Smith & Wesson thought that out very well, and it is real easy to change, and it comes with three back straps, small, medium, and large. And
Smith & Wesson would really want me to tell you it comes with the medium size installed. That if you pick one up at the store and you think it's just a little bit too big, you can put the smaller one on. And if you think it's a little bit too small, you can put the bigger one on.
And I made a mistake in my YouTube video that thousands of people have pointed out to me. The Shield does not come with interchangeable back straps. I said that on my YouTube video, and then I had to put a bunch of corrections in it and captions in it saying, okay, I screwed up.
Sorry.
So, yeah, sorry. The little Shields don't come with interchangeable back straps, but all of the regular size pistols do.
And that's the only drawback with the Shield, because the Shield is too small for me. If it had an interchangeable back strap, you know, I'd probably just run Smith & Wesson products, because that Shield is a cool gun. But really, if you put the Smith & Wesson Shield versus the Smith & Wesson M&P Compact, man, the size is really close together. A little bit further.
Well, the height and the length are close. The M&P 9 Compact is considerably fatter.
Yeah, the slide and the double stack magazine. But, yeah. You know, it's 8 rounds, I get 12.
Well, one thing I like about the M&P 9 Compact, I'm going to talk that up a little bit. My brother's got an M&P 9 Compact. What I like is it's halfway in between size-wise, halfway in between the Glock 19 and the Glock 26. It's bigger than a Glock 26. I don't care what anybody says. People compare it, but go to the gun store and hold up a Glock 26 next to an M&P 9 Compact, and you're going to find that the M&P 9 Compact is a bigger gun. Even with the flush magazine, it's a bigger gun. But it's smaller than the G19, and if you use the extended magazine, the one with the pinky extension on the M&P Compact, it's kind of cool because it's curved nicely, which makes it conceal nice, and it gives you that full grip, and it's still smaller than a G19, bigger than a G26.
Yeah, it's still small, but I don't know. I might buy one, I might not. I think I'm going to... Smith & Wesson's they gave me a list of guns that I can pick from, and I
a tough choice, huh?
Yeah.
Only one?
Yes. I asked the guy. He goes, you can either get this one for this price, or you can get the 5 1/4 inch, whatever they call it, their Pro Series, for a little bit higher price. And I was like, can I buy both?
Now, Ben, you got a lot of 9mm. Get the M&P Compact 45.
No, thanks.
No 45? Why not?
Get the 9mm, because I'm thinking about carrying it. I'm going to compare it.
Why won't you carry a 45?
Because I'm too cheap to buy the 45 ammo. you guys, that is literally why I choose a 9mm. The ammo is the cheapest. I can shoot the most with my 9mm. It does give me more ammo, though. You know?
45's been easier to find lately, though.
Yeah, but it was $25 a box this morning. I bought ammo this morning. 45 was on the shelf for $25 a box. 9mm was on the shelf for $12.99 a box.
Yeah, see, the advantages of 9mm are showing up again. We had a brief time where it was really tough to find them, but there you go. 25 versus 12, that's a big deal. And as we all know, I don't want to start a caliber argument here, but there's not enough difference in those two to justify the reduction in capacity in my view. My opinion only.
I like more beans to shoot at people, too, but my biggest thing, honestly, is because it's cheaper in ammo, so I can shoot almost twice as much and have twice as much fun for the same price as 45.
And you know, that M&P 4-inch gun seems to be a little bit smaller than a Glock 17. It just kind of feels a little smaller in my hand than a Glock 17 does.
I pulled the numbers. It is. The full-size M&P is smaller than is a little bit bigger than a 19, but it's smaller than a 17.
Now, so we're talking almost, the 4-inch model.
Yeah, it's almost in the middle again.
Right, we're not talking the competition M&P. M&P Pro Series,
yeah,
I think
the
they
Pro
call
Series.
It, right?
So, yeah, it's kind of funny. M&P made them all right in the center, you know. Their full-size duty weapon is right between the Glock 17 and the Glock 19.
Yeah.
And then the compact version is right there between the 19 and the 26. And their Pro Series is, like, a little bit bigger than 17, but a little bit smaller than the 34, which is Glock's competition version.
One quick question for you. I don't know if they covered this in the class, and then we'll wrap this up.
We'll cite someone. Yeah.
Barrel interchangeability. Can you do the same as Glock? Can you pull a 40 barrel out and stick a 357 SIG barrel in magazines and run it just fine?
I would assume so, but you have to find somebody that's aftermarking that stuff. Because that's what Glock isn't really doing it. You're getting aftermarket companies doing it. So I'd have to look. M&P, yeah, Smith & Wesson will tell you no. Glock will tell you no, don't do that.
Well, they'll tell you that, but the reality is I think you can do it.
It works.
It works.
So
you just have to figure out how to get a hold of an M&P 357 SIG barrel.
Right.
And magazines.
Right. And, well, the 40 magazine will work with your 357 SIG.
It will? No. I thought it wouldn't.
It will. Same length, same overall cartridge length, and the width of the back is the same.
Okay.
The only thing that's different is it's necked down to a 9mm.
Yeah, I know that. I just didn't think that the magazines would. I thought you'd have to match up the magazines.
Even though Glock says you should run the different guns, their magazines even say now 40/357 SIG on them.
Okay. So I'm kind of hankering for a M&P compact and 357 SIG. That just seems like that'd be a really cool gun. You know, because I'm not a big fan of the 40, but I love the 357 SIG cartridge.
Yeah, that would be cool.
And that I like the size of the M&P Compact series, not the Shield, but, oh, actually, maybe a Shield in 357 SIG would be kind of cool, too. But the M&P Compact, that just seems like that would be a neat gun.
Well, the other thing I might want to tell you, and this is going away from the M&P towards the Glock, what a Glock 2, they just went from the Gen 3 to the Gen 4, and we have all these law enforcement departments switching over from the Glock to the Smith & Wesson. What's that going to mean for us? There is going to be a lot of Glock trade-ins. They're mostly going to be Gen 3 guns, but they'll and 40s, but there'll be tons and tons of Glock 22s on the market that will be trade-ins. And I heard somebody just got one for $299.
There already are a ton of Glock 22 trade-ins. They're third gens. Hey, it's a good buy for $300. That's hard to pass up.
Yeah. So if you're looking for a Glock and 40, now might be the time. And if you think you really want the 357 SIG, like you. Lone Wolf Distributors makes a great drop-in barrel.
I wish there were Glock 23 trade-ins that I could get for $299 and then buy a 357 SIG barrel and magazines, and for the price of a new Glock, I got a cool gun.
Somebody always wants something that's not there.
I know. That's me. But anyway, we're talking about M&Ps mostly on this podcast, but, you know, Glock is a good comparison because, let's face it, I would say... I'm probably going to upset some XD fans out there, but I would say M&P, Smith & Wesson, is probably Glock's major competitor right now.
I think Glock is... I was going to say something worse, but I think Glock is in trouble with M&Ps being made in America. All these United States, like big departments, San Antonio PD, Austin PD, they're big departments here in Texas, and they've switched over from the Glock to the M&P family. And one of the biggest reasons is they can get them for the same price, but they can get better support because Smith & Wesson is an American company and they have more people here in America. So it's just, and one of the, I forget which law enforcement, honestly, he was telling me about it. And he said the number one reason they went from the Glock to the Smith & Wesson when Glock was trying to sell them the Gen 4 pistol was that they're made here in America.
Yeah, which Glocks are made in America now too, I'm pretty sure, or they're going to be very, very soon.
The rumor is very, very soon. They're not made here yet.
Yeah, not yet. But anyway, what you've said, Ben, and your review here is making me seriously think about getting an M&P pistol. And like I always like to do, I like to get something new and try it for quite some time before I decide to automatically switch. But you brought up a lot of good positive points. And, you know.
One last little point.
Okay, here we go. One last little point.
We talked about the sights. A Glock sight is almost unusable and will break on you. The plastic sights, we all know that. Well, the M&P actually comes with steel, almost Novak-style sights that are very, very good. They're right in the quality with the aftermarket sights of all the Glocks. And it's not just a little groove. It's actually long. They're pinned in there. The rear sight has a set screw. And it's more of that Novak or aftermarket style that you would see that moves the sight all the way to the back of the slide. Instead of Glock, just puts it the littlest piece of plastic they can and call it a sight in there. M&P actually did some work on the sights, and they put some good sights on the gun.
And for the new people, the advantage of moving that those dots to the back of the slide, the Novak style, is it increases your sight radius, which helps with longer distance shots. You know, the other thing I'll say about sights... Damien from Dallas, who listens a lot, he asked me to clarify this a few weeks ago, and I haven't done it. In one of my recent shows, I said that the Glock factory sights suck, and he wanted me to clarify that. So here's my clarification. You can still make hits with Glock factory sights because people have done it. They've come to the classes that we teach, and they're making hits. But they're made out of plastic, and that's why I think they suck, because they're made out of plastic. And they can break, and they've been known to break, especially the front sight. The front sight on a Glock is pretty fragile, the factory sight. And you know what? I mean, when you're making a precision shot, the Glock factory sights are really all not that good for precision. Inside of 10 yards, you know what, they're okay. But I just want to put that clarification out there. You know, for you new people, if you just bought a Glock, don't think you have to go change the sights right away. Shoot what you got first until you can afford the sights. But that's my clarification.
I'm with you on the Glock sights. I had plastic Glock sights, and I wasn't going to change them because that's what I used overseas, and it just worked until I really started working on that gun. And that front sight will wear on you. And when the front sight wears, what happens? It gets smaller. And honestly, you could see before I changed out my sights, the wear, and it was just from holster wear, just dragging it in and out of holsters.
Yeah.
The front sight wore down. Like, you could see where it had been grinded down a little bit, and that dot was now, the top of the sight was now on the dot, and the dot was starting to be not round anymore. I had worn it down so much.
Yeah, so another big plus for Smith & Wesson, the M&P sights that they're shipping are top-notch. Well, Ben, this was good. Good review on the M&P pistol, especially because now that you've taken an armorer's course, are you an expert?
I guess so. And now I can fix your gun when you break it again.
Now you can fix my gun. So when I get an M&P and it's broken, it's coming to you. If I need parts, it's coming to you. And I'll even maybe, as a Christmas gift, buy you a slide pusher.
Oh, so I can replace your sight?
A sight pusher. I said that wrong.
Sight push, so I can replace your front sight.
So you can replace my front sight on my shield, yeah.
Yeah, so I can work on your shield, too. It's the same gun, pretty
exactly,
much.
Exactly, pretty much. Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
No problem. Had fun. Thanks for all of you guys listening. We appreciate every single one of you listening out
there. Oh, real quick, you want to talk about the classes we got coming up?
Sure. What classes do we have coming up?
Well, by the time people listen to this podcast, our rifle class in San Antonio will be over. However, we have coming up in the middle, actually the end of this month, I believe it's the 24th or the 23rd. You got to look on our website. We're going to Dallas. We're doing the 4-hour. We call it Pistol Fighting Dynamics, and it's a 4-hour class. And mainly, I got to be honest, the reason it's only a 4-hour class, it's August, it's Texas, we're going to start early in the morning, be done before the major heat. However, the last people that came through one of our 4-hour classes thought it was just the right amount of time. So we got that coming up, Pistol Fighting Dynamics. There's still space left in that one.
And I just put a new curriculum together for that class. You guys are going to love it. I tested it on a couple people that I did private classes for. You're really going to like that one. It's the art of making, well, you say the art of making hits. I'll say it's the art of making the first hit, and you guys are going to really like that.
Well, stuff. The first hit's the most important one anyway. In September, we got level 2 of Beyond Concealed Carry. That's in San Antonio. So those of you who are graduates of our level 1 class, or if you've been to some other good course out there and you can prove it, come join us to take that. Now, that's a 2-day class. And it's going to be middle of September, somewhat hot, but not the blistering heat that we normally get. That's coming up in September. And then October, we're going down to the Rio Grande Valley. Talk about that one.
Oh, Brownsville should be fun. We have a great range set up there. It's huge. It's going to be almost right there, I think, on the water. I think the directions I were given is if you hit the beach, you've gone too far. So it's going to be a lot of fun just to be down that area.
Yeah, we can't shoot on the beach.
Yeah, well, no. But there's an actual range, and we'll have our own private area and everything. But it's a huge range, I'm told. We have a host down there. He's taken the class from us a couple times, driven up, him and his wife. They're great people. I'm really excited to go down there and meet some of you guys down there. Come out and take that class. We're going to do our Beyond Concealed Carry class. It's a one-day, $150 course. You will be doing things with a pistol that you never thought you could do. You'll be shooting faster, and you'll be shooting on the move by the end of the day and actually making hits where most people say that you can't make hits. I mean, we'll have you making hits doing things that people say you aren't possible, except for like Jerry Miklich and the top shooters in the world.
Yep, exactly. And also, I just put it up on the schedule through Suarez International. I'm teaching point shooting gunfight skills. It's not the same course that Roger Phillips teaches. He teaches point shooting progressions. Point shooting gunfight skills, I'm going to have you point shooting, and you're going to be introduced to the entire Suarez curriculum. It's also pretty good for beginners because we're going to start basics, so don't think you have to have a whole bunch of extensive training to come to that. That's going to be in San Antonio December 7th and 8th. The weather's still pretty nice down here in first week in December. You're not going to be freezing, so for you northerners, if you want to escape the heat and come down and train, that's 2 days. That's 2 days, and I'll put a link. By the time this show airs, there'll be a link on my site where you can go sign up for that. But that's point shooting gunfight skills, and I'll be teaching the Suarez curriculum on that one.
That'll be cool. We took, both of us took point shooting progressions. Roger Phillips was here, and it's pretty cool. It's a pretty good idea. And
I'm no Roger Phillips by any means, but you're going to learn. You'll be doing things in point shooting gunfight skills that you didn't think you could do as well.
It's super easy once you have somebody break it down to teach it to you. All you guys that think you can't point shoot, point your finger at something. It's that easy.
Yep. And by the way, we are going to, Ben, I think we talked about it. We got to finalize it, but I think we're going to do another one-day rifle class in San Antonio in October.
Okay, cool.
So there, we just we got to nail down the date and everything. I think it's the 12th, but just, folks, be watching the website, either handgunworld.com or modernselfprotection.com. Listen to Ben's show, Modern Self Protection Podcast, modernselfprotection.com. Search it on iTunes. Don't forget about our Shooters Club. We just put up two new videos on that. Another one's coming soon on how to bore sight your rifle. Right, Ben?
Yeah, that'll be great. I have people in the shop and everybody else. It's really not how to get a zero, but it's how to get you on paper so it's really easy to get a zero on your rifle and your scope. Real simple technique. Once you see it, you'll be like, really, it's that easy? Yeah, it's that easy.
And for you preppers out there, I just put up a new audio podcast on the Shooters Club. So if you like some prepping, there's some good ideas on there. Mexican Joe did an interview with Ghost, and it's pretty good. Ghost has excellent military background, but he's a big-time prepper, talks a lot about that. $75 a year, and you get videos, audios. We broke it down. It comes down to about $3 or $4 per episode. That's a pretty good deal.
Plus, you get to support what we're doing here, all these episodes, all the episodes I do over there, the extra stuff that I do for Bob in the middle of the week, and it's just kind of a way, you know. Hey, Gary Vaynerchuk says it's the thank you economy. So if you guys really want to support us and you think we're doing a great job and you think it's worth your time and some of your money, go over there. We don't take donations. We want to give you something extra. Go over there and sign up for the $75 a year.
And discounts with firearms retailers will be coming soon to all Shooters Club members. So with that, Ben, thanks for joining and talking about the M&P and the Armorers course. Good job. Let's go in that gun store, see what they got.
Okay, yeah. Listen to us. We're going to go into a gun show after a podcast. Perfect.
Later. Bye. Okay, well, what do you think? After thinking about the interview, I don't know if Ben's got everything correct about disassembling a Glock, because I'm not quite sure that there's that many pins. I don't know. Some of you might know better. Correct me. You know, it's been a long time since I've completely taken apart my Glock. I actually took one of the Glock Armorers classes that John Payne at Suarez International teaches. He teaches a pretty nice Glock Armorers class, and I took that class several months ago, and quite frankly, that's the last time I completely broke down one of my Glocks, but they're pretty simple pistols. So I don't know. I don't know if I would agree that the M&P is simpler, but it doesn't sound as complicated as I thought that it was after talking to Ben about it. And, of course, if I get an M&P pistol, then Ben's my certified armorer that can work on the doggone thing if I need it. So, with all that said, tell me what you think. That's kind of pretty much how I want to leave this interview. Very good stuff, Ben. Thank you very much. Very, very good stuff. Check out his podcast, by the way, Modern Self Protection. That's the name of his podcast. Good stuff, Ben. You know, I learned some stuff about the M&P I just didn't know. And I like the expansion of my knowledge base. You know, somebody on the forum, hey, and by the way, the most recent episode, or not the most recent, but one of the episodes I recently did on the good and the bad about the gun culture, it's getting a lot of replies on the forum, and there's something I want to say about that. So as I close the show, I want to close with this. To Steve at the Power Factor Show and to Devro on the forum, hey, guys, you know, I'm not trying to make outcasts out of any gun owner, okay? I'm not trying to chastise anybody. You know, when Paul Lathrop put the comment in his audio to me that, you know, we need to make it socially unacceptable to not get training with your gun, I don't think that he was talking about dividing the gun community into, you know, the elites and the non-elites. I don't think that's what he was referring to, and it's certainly not what I was referring to. I think you guys have kind of taken that to another level that I never meant it to be. And by the way, that mixed bag of gun talk, there were several topics in there, and that thread seems to be just focusing on one thing that I said or that Paul Lathrop said. You know,
I said it before. I don't think that competition and reading books and watching videos is complete training, but it does help you learn things, and it does help you learn how to practice and possibly what to practice. And the value of a class is, you know, an instructor can watch you and help you. And a lot of people benefit from that. But guys, come on. You know, I practice what I preach on this show. I back it up. I took people shooting weekend before last. I took eight people shooting. No, that was last weekend. What am I saying? I took eight people shooting. Several of them have never shot a handgun before, and most of them have never shot an AR-15 before. So I took out all my handguns, and they brought some, and I brought both my AR-15s, and they got a pretty cool experience. I rented one of the training bays that I typically use for classes for 3 hours. I paid for their range fees, and we had a great time. I practice what I preach, gang. Maybe the mistake I make, and this is something that maybe I need to do some soul-searching inside myself. You tell me. Maybe the mistake that I sometimes make is that other people take this as seriously as I do. Because I take it seriously. I know that there's a very slim chance that we would ever have to use our gun. I know that's a very slim chance. As a matter of fact, probably 99% of us who listen to this show will go the rest of our life never having to use our gun. I still take it seriously. I take everything else I do seriously. I take my real job seriously. I take being a family man seriously. I take doing this podcast seriously. I take prepping seriously, which is why I still do today's survival show. I talk about, you know, how to be a common sense prepper to prepare for disasters and things. So I guess the mistake I make is maybe some people don't. And I'm not trying to chastise them, and I'm not trying to put them down. I'm trying to be a motivator. I've taken a lot of people competition shooting for the first time, and they love it. Now, I donate to gun rights causes. I donate to the Second Amendment Foundation, and I'm an NRA member. And I've raised money for the Gun Rights Radio Network and given back to Mark's network and things like that. So, you know, I put my money where my mouth is, I put my time where my mouth is, and I practice what I preach, gentlemen. And so, I guess I have to kind of take a little bit of offense to you guys trying to imply that I'm trying to divide gun owners or chastise gun owners who don't get training. It's not what I'm doing. It's not what I'm doing. I'm trying to encourage them to get the training because I know the value of it. I know the value of it. And you know what? If nothing else, if you don't ever use your handgun, it's so much fun. Training with firearms is a blast. No pun intended. It's fun, people. It is really a lot of fun. I just want you to enjoy in the fun. How about that? Shooting competition, IDPA, USPSA. Recently, I shot AASA, which is American Action Shooting Association. That was a lot of fun. So, you know, this is great recreation and great camaraderie that you build. And I want you to be a part of that. So what I was talking about is I'm talking about the many, many, many gun owners. Some of them new gun owners, some of them not, that have thousands, literally thousands of dollars invested in firearms in their safes. And they don't go out too much and do any competition shooting, and they don't take any classes, and, you know, they just kind of sit there, and their guns sit there. And maybe they throw a pistol in the glove box in their pickup or in their car, and that's about all they ever do. And they went to their CHL class or CCW class or whatever, and they think, okay, that's it, I got it. My daddy taught me to shoot when I was 12, so I'm in good shape. They're missing out. They're missing out on such fun. Let's just put it that way. They're just missing out on a real blast. So that's the only place that I'm going with that. And, you know, I wanted to kind of close the show with those comments. But, you know, folks, I'm going to promise you something right now. I'm never going to say anything on this show that I won't at least do or try one time. And so, you know, I live this stuff, folks. I practice what I preach, and this is not my full-time job. You know, I love what I do full-time, but this is a passionate hobby of mine, and I want to share it with you, and I'll just kind of leave it at that. Once again, I'm getting kind of convinced to try an M&P pistol again. With all that said, I'm Bob Main. Hey, and by the way, don't forget, if you want to follow me on Facebook, you can find a link for that at handgunworld.com. You can find a link there for the Shooters Club podcast, as Ben and I talked about. More videos coming up on that pretty soon. And you can find links to all the classes that we have coming up over at handgunworld.com. I'm Bob Main. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Shoot straight, shoot safe, and remember, the loudest sound that a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. Shoot straight, shoot safe. Give your pistols 1,000 rounds and trigger. Goodbye.